The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Can you hear me? Good evening. I'm Frank Wilson, the book editor of The Enquirer. I promise to be brief. Everybody likes that. The two authors who are joining us tonight have a couple of things obviously in common. Both are Irish. John Banville hails from County Wexford, and Colin McCann was born in Dublin. There's something else they have in common, along with every other Irish writer that I've ever read, namely that they have an appreciation that words aren't simply, or even principally, letters written on a page, but rather that they're sounds made by the human voice that linger and ring in the ear and resonate in the mind and the heart. You can't read an Irish writer by just looking at the words. You have to hear them. You have to let them sink in and sink down into your consciousness, because to a large extent, that's where a lot of the fun of reading them comes, but that's also where the deep, true meaning resides. But because they're Irish, John Banville and Colin McCann are quite distinctly individual. And so their books, apart from being beautifully written and shaped, don't really have all that much in common. Christine Falls, written under the name Benjamin Black, is a crime novel. And what is interesting about it is that it reminds you that maybe the worst crimes are not necessarily those that have been prohibited by statute. It takes place mostly in Ireland, but to a little bit in a place called Scituate, Massachusetts. Colin McCann Zoli goes in quite another direction. It starts in Slovakia and wanders about Europe, chronicling the adventures of, or the travels of, Zoli, the title character, a poet, following what I think you can fairly describe as the pilgrimage that is her life. And with that, you've heard everything you need to from me. So I'm going to let you hear what these works sound like. And first, we're going to hear from Colin McCann. Please.
Hello. How are you? Thank you for coming along. It's a pleasure to be here. I love coming to libraries. So much of my life is actually spent in libraries, my work. And this book here, Zoli, is actually, it's dedicated to librarians. So if there are any of you out there, how many librarians are out there? There's a few. I can see a few. Thank you for all the work that you do. It seems to me that the unsung heroes of literature happen to be translators and librarians. So I have a frog in my throat. I spent a lot of time on 40. I like to say I was on 42nd Street researching this novel, which sounds much more exotic than what it was. I was in the library on 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue, in the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers, where they gave me access to a book and access to their archives, and you could walk around the library and be part of all those 6 million volumes that they had actually there on the premises. And I think many millions more, many millions more off-site as well. And it's quite kind of wonderful to think that you can wander in and through and be part of those stories. This book, I'm going to read a little bit from Zoli, and then a small piece from my novel Dancer, which is the novel prior to this one. which was a fictionalization of the life of Rudolf Nureyev. But this book, Zoli, is based on the true story of Papuszka, a Polish poet who in the 1950s was discovered by Jerzy Fakowski, who was later a triumphant fan of Bruno Schulz, the Polish writer. But what happened was that Jerzy Fakowski found this gypsy poet, this Romani woman, who was with a traveling compania of harpists, and she had taught herself how to read and to write. And he encouraged her to write her songs down, which eventually became her downfall because she was exiled by her people. For many reasons that I can't really go into tonight, but that the book sort of hopes to get at. Issues of politics, issues of belief, issues of belonging, of exile, of borders, of all these things. And I'm actually going to read to you from almost the last page, which sounds like I'm going to give things away, but it was also, at one stage, it was also going to be almost the first page. So, and this is just a moment where, based on something I saw in the settlements, in the gypsy settlements, when I went to go there in Slovakia, I saw a woman put out a sheet of siding and sprinkle salt upon it and then play a violin bow along the sheet of salt so that she didn't really know what she was doing, but in a way she was creating a Stadli map, a sound chart. And so this is what Zoli does. She used to play the sugar, excuse me, she used to play the sugar upon the metal, she recalls, in those old days when she gathered children at the back of her wagon. She would place a sheet of siding on a wooden sawhorse, sprinkle the sugar on the sheet, sometimes salt, or if nothing else, seeds. She teased the violin bow along the very edge of the plate until the metal began to hum. The sugar jumped and swerved and found its own vibrating patterns, standing waves, circular clumps, solitary grains like small white acrobats. Afterwards, the children clamored to lick the sheet clean. She had loved those maps, their random patterns, their odd music, the way the children clapped the sugar into place. She had never thought of them as anything new or unusual, although she heard that others called them chladnis, sound charts, the sugar settling at the points where there was least sound. And she thought, even then, that she could have looked at the metal sheet and found a whole history of her people painted there. And the history of her people is actually a history that I was tremendously ignorant of when I first started researching what we commonly call the gypsies, but really are the Roma. A Rom is a single gypsy person. The Roma are the people, literally in the Romani language. And Romani is also the adjective and the language itself. But I've had the most extraordinary series of people come to me at various readings since I've written this book who are from Roma background. And they've sort of thanked me because this story is sort of amazingly untold in the Europe. Sometimes it seems like all the stories have been told, but I'm reminded of John Berger, the great English novelist who lives in the south of France. He says, never again will a single story be told as if it were the only one. And this particular section of the novel that I'm going to read to you from is narrated by Stephen Swan, who's half Irish for his sins and half Slovakian, and even worse, he lives in England. So then he moves to Slovakia just after the war and becomes part of the socialist movement, which, based on the true stories, sort of instituted a Black is Beautiful movement for the citizens of gypsy origin. And what happened was there was this great movement to sort of elevate the Romani people. But this section is about politics. This section about tunnels is really about politics. And what happens when our love sort of clashes with the truth. He's fallen in love with Zoli, but things are starting to fall apart. They're taking the gypsy people in off the roads. They're requisitioning their horses. They're chopping the wheels off the wagons and burning the wheels and settling them in the tower blocks. The rumors picked up speed. If I had ransomed everything and given it to her, it would still never have been enough. Her people were not able to stand outside the true bend of gravity. The force was always downwards, even if the inclination was to raise them up. There was no single hour when it all came about, but things had begun to slip. More talk of Law 74, the end of nomadism, the big halt. Some ignored it. Others embraced it, saw it as a way to fill up their pockets and call themselves gypsy kings, a notion that meant nothing to Zoli and her people. The crux of the matter was assimilation, belonging, ethnic identity. We wanted them, but they wanted us to leave them alone. And yet the only way to be left alone was to let us know what their life was, and their life was in Zoli's songs. On the motorbike, we drove east to meet with local officials in Zilnia, Poprad, Preshov, Martin. In town meetings, she spoke about tradition and nationhood, about the old life, against assimilation. She had written down the poems, she said, in order to sing the old life, nothing more. Her politics were those of road and grass. She leaned forward into microphones. Don't try to change us. We're complete, citizens of our own space. The bureaucrats stared at her and nodded blankly. Simply being who she was aroused an expectation amongst them. They wanted her in the gypsy jam jar. They nodded and showed us the door, assured us that they were on our side. But anyone could see that they were separated from honesty by fear. Nor could we be rescued by the forces of beauty around us. We clattered down the potholed roads through valleys beneath the snow-capped eastern mountains. And in the early mornings when small houseflies still dawdled by the rivers, a smoke of mayflies drifting in the air, I opened my mouth and it filled with midges. The journey hammered me down, a deadness in my fingers. Climbing on the bike, the day seemed to stretch out endless. Zoli carried her clothes in a zadia blanket stretched around her back, two knots tied at the chest. She had already scarred her left leg on the heat of the exhaust pipe, but she did not stop. She applied her own poultice from dock leaves. Town to town, hall to hall. In the evening, we stayed at the homes of Gadze activists. Even they had become silent. I walked around with a hollow pit in my stomach. Whole marching bands of children went through the streets wearing red scarves, shouting slogans. The loudspeakers seemed to be turned up a notch. For long stretches, we found in ourselves little to say. In the corridors of community offices all over the country, Zoli tore down her face from the walls, shredded the pieces, put them in her pocket. Citizens of gypsy origin, come join us. We stayed one night in a monastery that had become a hotel. It was shoddy and ruined, full of plastic plants and cheap prints. The bites that woke me were from bedbugs concealed under a loose corner of wallpaper. Bells rang out in the early morning, calling workers to their jobs. I rose and washed my arms and face in the hand basin, paid the plump woman at the front desk. She sat in a bright plastic chair and regarded me, diligently bored, though she sat upright when she saw Zoli, recognizing her from the newspapers. As we rode from the monastery, a series of thin and trembling images caught in the rain puddles. Moving feet, windows, a small slice of steel-coloured sky. I had the very ordinary thought that surely there was an easier life elsewhere. Zoli and I waited for an hour to fill up the petrol tank. The motorbike was a curiosity with young children on their way to school. They were fascinated by the speedometer. She lifted the children and allowed them to pretend that they were driving. They laughed and clapped as she pushed them along, school satchels slung over their shoulders until they were shooed off by the petrol attendant. In the evening, we reached Martin, a grey little town along the Vaal River. We were refused a hotel room until Zoli showed her party card. And even then, she was told there was only one room left, though there were four single beds in it. It was on the top floor, something she always resisted unless she was sure there were no gypsy men beneath her. Every now and then, she dredged up some of the ancient ways, and it was possible in the old blood laws to contaminate men by walking above them. She eventually managed to get a first floor room with the suggestion that she'd throw a curse on the clerk. Alarmed, he scuttled away and came back moments later with the keys. It was a form of voodoo that she used only in the worst cases. She threw her bag on the soft mattress and we left for a meeting with the local officials, three cultural inspectors who'd formerly been priests. All Zoli wanted to do was to hold a hand up against the tide that she felt was washing over her, but Law 74 had become part of the vocabulary now. The idea was that the gypsies were part of the apparatus. Zoli pleaded with them, but the officials smiled and doodled nervously at the edge of ledgers. "Shit on you," she said to them, and she walked out into the front courtyard, sat with her head on her hands. "Maybe I should sing a song for them, Swan," she said. She spat on the ground. "Maybe I should just jangle my bracelets, huh?" In the local market, she came across a family of Roma who'd been burned out of a sawmill and had nowhere left to sleep. She brought them through the lobby of the hotel, 11 or 12 of them at least, not including children, and promised the clerk that they'd be out first thing in the morning. His jaw hung slack, but he allowed them to pass. In the room, I set up a makeshift sheet around one bed so as not to be improper. I tried to leave so she and the family would have the room to themselves, but neither Zoli nor the others would have any of it. They insisted I stay in the bed. The women and children giggled as I undressed. My ankles were exposed underneath the hanging sheet. It was what they deemed immodest. Part of the curtain fell aside, and I watched as they gathered in the middle of the room and talked in a dialect I couldn't make out. It seemed they were talking of burnings. When I woke, I saw Zoli in the pre-dawn dark, climbing out the window. All the others had already gone from the room. When she returned, she held in her hand a wet cloth that I assumed she must have wiped in the dew. She lit a candle, placed it in an ashtray, and curved her hand around it as if to shield the light from me. She leaned forward, and her long black hair fell before her. She pressed the wet cloth along the length of it a number of times. She brushed it as many more times with a wooden comb, then gathered her hair, coiled it, braided it. The ceiling skipped with shadow. She slipped into the far bed. When I stood up and walked over to her, she did not move. She lay with her back to me, her neck bare. A draft flattened the candle flame. She allowed my arm across her waist. She said there were many things she missed in her life, not least a sinewy voice that might come up from beneath the ice. I nudged in against her, kissed the back of her hair. It smelled of grass. "Marry me," I said to her. "What?" she said, speaking towards the window, not as a question nor an exclamation, but something distant and unfathomable. "You heard me." She turned and gazed someplace beyond me. "Haven't we lost enough?" she said. She turned and kissed me briefly as she lowered the guillotine for one final time. And I was grateful in a way that she had waited so long. A single phrase and yet it hit me with the force of an axe. She'd put down a line between us, one I could never again cross. Zoli rose and gathered her possessions. When she left the room, I punched the wall and heard a knuckle crack. She was waiting outside. I had to drive her to another town. She smiled slightly at the sight of my fist wrapped in a towel. And for a brief moment, I hated her and all the bareness she brought to her life. "You gotta drive me through the mountains," she said. "I can't stand the idea of those tunnels." And yet, we were in a tunnel anyway. We knew it, and maybe we always had been. We had sped into the arch of darkness, slowed down, steered a moment in the unusual cold until it felt right, and then we jolted that bike forward again, pushed against the headlong wind. We had recognized a pinpoint of light, a tiny gleam that kept growing, and the longer we journeyed in the darkness, the more dazzling the light had become, ever brighter, more brilliant, and we leaned forward onto the handlebars until eventually, like everyone, we had approached the mouth of the tunnel. Then we smashed that motorbike out into the sunshine, momentarily blinded, stunned, and we stayed so for quite a while, until our eyes adjusted and we began to blink and things came into focus, and all around us were pebbles, and amongst the pebbles, stones, and amongst the stones, rubbish, and amongst the rubbish, small grey buildings, and between and beyond, pockets of grey men and women, a wasteland of them, ourselves. And instead of letting our hearts sink, we closed our eyes once more and we rode that bike into another darkness, another tunnel, thinking there would be a brighter light just a little further along, that nothing would derail us, and that belief, like most beliefs, became more precious than the truth. What is there to say? Stransky's last words to the firing squad: come closer, it will be easier for you. Okay, and thank you. It's getting warm. One last piece. That was for Chicky. And this piece is for my friend James, my friends James and Mary. This is from Dancer. This is a section of the novel about Rudolf Nureyev that my mother asked me, she says, how do you know that? It's sort of rude. So, how do you know that stuff? And it all takes place in the gay underground in New York in 1975. My wife asked me too, so. It's 40 pages long, it's one sentence, and I swear I'll only read the first page and a half and then the last paragraph. I just want to give it a flavour of New York 75 and the whole idea behind the music and the movement of the piece is to feel like you're on some sort of cocaine trip. And the character is Victor Parici from Venezuela. New York, 1975. I have to take a big breath for this one. Check my time, I'm okay. It is one of those heartless streets you find in parts of the city where the light is still tense with yesterday's darkness. And even in the late afternoon, it already feels like curfew, and the spent trash of the day goes skidding along, and the pigeons sit grey on the chain-link fences, and the traffic is stalled, fume-blowing, and the storefronts are dark and shadowy with filth and grime. 11th Street and C, Lower East, all smack and suicide. But Victor breaks it simply by moving down the sidewalk, making walking into a sort of dancing. Beginning in the shoulders with a symmetrical roll that not even the blacks have perfected. One oblong shrug of a shoulder and then the other, as if connected by synaptical cogs, and first the left and then the right. But not just the shoulders, the roll moves down into his chest, into his ribcage, through the rest of his body, down to his toes. God made me short so I could blow basketball players without ruining my knees. Then up again to rest for a moment in his hips, nothing flagrant, no lead to bring attention. The walk alone pays homage to his crotch. So if you're sitting on a brownstone stoop, high or hungover or both, you look up through the shit and the grime and the thousand other everyday torments too deep to mention, and you see Victor coming along, looking like he's the first man ever to whistle, in his tight black pants and his neon orange shirt, his black hair swept back, his teeth white underneath his dark moustache, and his body in a role that isn't jazz or funk or foxtrot or disco. It's just pure Victor from head to toe, an art he must have managed since birth, laughing as he walks. A chuckle that rises high and ends low, a Victor laugh on impulse, like his own body has just told him a little joke about himself. And the whole day slips away from you while you watch him. The clocks stop, the guitars tune themselves in unison, the air conditioners hum like violins, the garbage trucks sound like flutes. And you sit rooted to the steps as Victor waves to the other queens hanging out the windows, wigs and feathers and lust, while he crushes a cigarette or ties a shoelace or raps upon a window pane using a silver dollar so it sounds out. And there are whistles and catcalls, Victor having become even more famous 6 years ago after the riots in Sheridan Square when he was arrested for violence and nudity. Yeah, nude violence! But then managed a hand job from a tall blonde cop in the 6th Precinct Station. So Victor was talked about, laughed about, cheered in the bars, baths, back rooms of the city, and he moves on. in the empire of himself, taking a bow in front of the windowsills, Victor having learned every inch of the bow from his good friend Rudy Neveroff. Holding the bend, arching his back, sweeping his arm to the sky, frozen a second, grinning, then walking again in the sequence of sun and shadow down to the corner smoke shop where he hauls deep on a joint with the pretty Puerto Rican boys who polish Victor's shoes with a white bandana while he goes inside barefoot to tell the shop owner, "Man, they should arrest the mass murderer who gave you that haircut." His own hair so thick and slick it shines under the shop neon, buying himself a packet of Lucky Strikes, his whole life a string of Lucky Strikes, from the streets of Caracas to the cockcrow of the New World, beginning as a carpenter, then a waiter, then a hustler, then a house painter, and after Stonewall, an interior designer. Yeah, I'll design your interior. Taking only enough business to live the way he wants, knowing that the less a man works, the more he's paid, one of the simple rules of New York City. And Victor has over the years proved many such simple rules to himself, his favorite being that if you live your life without falling in love, you'll be loved by everyone. One of the great laws of love and fuckery. You take what you can get and you move swiftly away, no looking back, so that even the pretty Puerto Rican boys on the stoop can't hold him after sharing half their joint. He's gone once more, brightening the next street and then the next, hailed while shimmying along, the dealers reaching into their tight yellow trousers for a couple of quaaludes, free of charge, saying, "Victor, my man, you tell those blue bloods where the real shit is at." All the dealers hoping for Victor business later that night, since Victor business is good business. Victor might well guide a large troop to your stoop so you can wake up tomorrow slung alongside your sweetheart, with your heart singing and a fat roll of 20s under your pillow, and Victor smiles as he takes the pills, saying, "Gracias," one of the two Spanish words he uses, gracias and cojones. Both of them pronounced in three long syllables, like he's chewing for a moment on the childhood memory of Venezuela, the filth, the dogs, the soccer balls rolling towards the sewer pipes. And what happens during the whole section is that they go out in the town and they go down to the baths, and at the very end they get separated from each other, and this is just 10 lines, because I think we're always moving towards our last lines, to sort of where Victor is left alone. And he sees somebody coming down the street. They're on the west side of Manhattan in the trucks where a lot of the characters used to gather in the 70s. And just before Victor climbs into the rear of a truck, who knows, the world may very well end before sunrise. He looks up the cobblestone street and he sees a lone man walking towards the trucks, disturbing the globes of lamplight, moving with certainty and grace, the volume of the walk turned up so that Victor's attention is arrested, and instantly he knows, because he recognizes the leather hat, the bend of the brim, the lean of the body, and Victor feels a rush of emotion like wind over grass, causing the hairs on his arms to tingle, and Rudy shouts, "You Venezuelan turd, you left me there!" And he is laughing, his whole face worked into happiness, showing his fine white teeth, and a tremor runs through Victor's spine as he watches Rudy approach, thinking, here comes loneliness, applauding itself all the way down the street. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, good evening. The great English poet Philip Larkin was once asked why he didn't do public poetry readings. He said that he wasn't prepared to go about the country pretending to be himself. I appear before you pretending to be somebody else. I don't know whether that's good or bad. I'll read to you from Christine Falls. It's written by Benjamin Black, who is me and also not me. I'll read from the opening pages and then a little bit from later on. The book is set in the 1950s. The protagonist, I suppose we may call him the protagonist, is a man called Quirk. He's a pathologist who works in a Dublin hospital. But this opening section is slightly enigmatic, but it is the first couple of pages, so you will be as wise as I am when you listen to it. She was glad it was the evening mail boat she was taking, for she did not think she could have faced a morning departure. At the party the night before, one of the medical students had found a flask of raw alcohol and mixed it with orange crush, and she had drunk two glasses of it, and the inside of her mouth was still raw, and there was something like a drum beating behind her forehead. She had stayed in bed all morning, still tipsy, unable to sleep, and crying half the time, a hanky crushed to her mouth to stifle the sobs. She was frightened at the thought of what she had to do today, of what she had to undertake. Yes, she was frightened. At Dunleary, she paced back and forth on the pier, too agitated inside herself to stand still. She had put her luggage in the cabinet and come back down to the dock to wait, as they had told her to. She did not know why she'd agreed to what had been asked of her. She already had the offer of a job in Boston, and now there had been the prospect of the money as well, but she suspected it was more that she'd been afraid of Matron, afraid to refuse what she'd been asked, afraid to refuse when she'd been asked if she would bring the child with her. Matron had a way of sounding the most intimidating when she spoke the softest. "Now, Brenda," she had said, looking at her with those goggle eyes of hers, "I want you to consider carefully, because it's a big responsibility." Everything had felt strange, the sick sensation in her stomach and the burning in her mouth from the alcohol, and the fact that she was not wearing her nurse's uniform, but the pink wool costume she had bought specially to go away in, her going away suit, as if she was getting married, when instead of a honeymoon, she would have a week of taking care of this baby, and not a hint of a husband. "You're a good girl, Brenda," Matron had said, putting on a smile that was worse than one of her glares. "May God go with you." She would need his company, all right, she thought mournfully now. There was tonight on the boat, then the train journey tomorrow to Southampton, then 5 more days at sea, and then what? She had never been out of the country before, except once, when she was little and her father took the family on a day trip to the Isle of Man. A sleek black motor car was edging its way through the crowds of passengers going towards the boat. It stopped when it was still a good 10 yards away from her, and a woman got out of the passenger side with a canvas bag in her hand and a bundle and a blanket in the crook of her other arm. She was not young, 60 if she was a day, but was dressed as if she were half that, in a grey suit with a narrow calf-length skirt belted tightly at the waist, her little pot belly sticking out under the belt, and a pillbox hat with a bit of blue veil that came down below her nose. She walked forward over the flagstones, unsteady in stiletto heels, her painted-on mouth pursed in a smile. Her eyes were small and black and sharp. "Miss Rutledge," she said, "my name is Moran." Her fancy accent was as fake as everything else about her. She handed over the bag. "The baby's things are in there with her papers. Give them to the purser when you get on board at Southampton. He know who you are." She examined Brenda closely, making slits of her little black eyes. "Are you all right?" she said. "You look pale." Brenda said she was fine, that she'd been up late, that was all. Miss Moran, or Mrs., or whatever she was, smiled thinly. "The parting glass, eh?" She held out the bundle in the blanket. "Here you are. Don't drop it." She laughed shortly, then frowned at herself and said sorry. What struck Brenda first about the bundle was the heat. It might have been a lump of burning coal that was wrapped in the blanket, except that it was soft and that it moved. When she held it against her breast, something in her insides flipped like a fish. "Oh," she said, a weak gasp of surprise and happy dismay. The woman was speaking to her again, but she was not listening. From deep down in the folds of the blanket, a tiny, filmy eye was regarding her with what seemed an expression of dispassionate interest. Her throat thickened, and she was afraid the morning's waterworks might start up again. "Thank you," she said. It was all she could think to say, although she was not sure who it was she was thanking or for what. The Moran woman shrugged, pulling her mouth up at one side in a sketch of a smile. "Good luck," she said. She walked back rapidly to the car, her high heels clicking, and got in and pulled the door shut. "Well, that's done," she said. And through the windscreen she watched Brenda Rutledge, still standing where she'd left her on the dock, gazing into the opening of the blanket, the canvas bag forgotten at her feet. "Look at her," she said sourly. thinks she's the Blessed Virgin. The driver made no comment, only started up the car. It was not the dead that seemed to quirk uncanny, but the living. When he walked into the morgue long after midnight and saw Malachi Griffin there, he felt a shiver along his spine that was to prove prophetic, a tremor of troubles to come. Mal was in Quirk's office, sitting at Quirk's desk. Quirk stopped in the unlit body room among the shrouded forms in their trolleys and watched him through the open doorway. Mal was seated with his back to the door, leaning forwards intently in his steel-framed spectacles, the desk lamp lighting the left side of his face and making an angry pink glow through the shell of his ear. He had a file open on the desk before him and was writing in it with peculiar awkwardness. This would have struck Quirk as stranger than it did had he not been drunk. The scene sparked a memory in him from their school days together, startlingly clear, of Mal, intent like this, sitting at a desk among 50 other earnest students in a big, hushed hall as he laboriously composed an examination essay with a beam of sunlight falling slantways on him from a window somewhere high above. A quarter of a century later, he still had that smooth seal's head of oiled black hair, scrupulously combed and parted. Sensing a presence behind him, Mal turned his face and peered into the shadowy dark of the body room. Quirk waited a moment and then stepped forward with some unsteadiness into the light in the doorway. "Quirk," Mal said, recognizing him with relief and giving an exasperated sigh. "For God's sake." Mal was in evening clothes, but uncharacteristically unbuttoned, his bow tie undone and the collar of his white dress shirt open. Quirk, groping in his pockets for his cigarettes, contemplated him, noting the way he put his forearm quickly over the file to hide it, and was reminded again of school. "Working late," Quirk said, and grinned crookedly, the alcohol allowing him to think it a telling piece of wit. "What are you doing here?" Mal said, too loudly. He pushed the spectacles up the damp ridge of his nose with a tap of a fingertip. He was nervous. Quirk pointed to the ceiling. "Party," he said, "upstairs." Mal assumed his consultant's face, frowning imperiously. "Party? What party?" "Brenda Rutledge," Quirk said. "One of the nurses. Her going away." Mal's frown deepened. "Rutledge?" Quirk was suddenly bored. He asked if Mal had a cigarette, for he seemed to have none of his own, but Mal said nothing. He stood up, deftly sweeping the file with him, still trying to hide it under his arm. Quirk, though he had to squint, saw the name scrawled in large handwritten letters on the cover of it. Christine Falls. "How is Sarah?" Quirk asked. He let himself droop sideways heavily until his shoulder found the support of the door jamb. He felt dizzy and everything was keeping up a flickering leftward lurch. Mal had his back to him, putting the file into a drawer of the tall grey filing cabinet. "She's well," Mal said. "We were at a night's dinner. I sent her home in a taxi." "Nights?" Quirk said, widening his eyes blearily. Mal turned to him a blank, expressionless look, the lenses of his glasses flashing. "The nights of St. Patrick, as if you didn't know." "Oh," Quirk said. "Right." He looked as if he was trying not to laugh. "Anyway," he said, "never mind about me. What are you doing down here among the dead men?" Mal had a way of bulging out his eyes and drawing upward sinuously his already long, thin form, as if to the music of a snake charmer's flute. And Quirk had to marvel, not for the first time, at the polished lustre of that hair, the smoothness of the brow beneath, the untarnished, steely blue of his eyes behind the pebble glass of his specs. "I had a thing to do," Mal said, "a thing to check." "What thing?" Quirk asked. Mal did not answer. He studied Quirk and saw how drunk he was, and a cold glint of relief came into his eye. "You should go home," he said. Quirk thought to dispute this. The morgue was his domain. But again, suddenly, he lost all interest. He shrugged, and with Mal still watching him, he turned and weaved away among the body-bearing trolleys. Halfway across the room, he stumbled and reached out quickly to the edge of a trolley to steady himself, but managed only to grab the sheet, which came away in his hand in a hissing white flash. He was struck by the clammy coldness of the nylon. It had a human feel, like a loose, chill cowl of bloodless skin. the corpse was that of a young woman, slim and yellow-haired. She had been pretty, but death had robbed her of her features, and now she might be a carving in soapstone, primitive and bland. Something his pathologist's instinct, perhaps, told him what the name would be before he looked at the label tied to her toe. "Christine Falls," he murmured. "You were well named." Looking more closely, he noticed the dark roots of her hair at forehead and temples, dead and not even a real blonde. It was after lunch by the time he could get up the energy to drag himself into work. As he entered the pathology department, Wilkins and Sinclair, his assistants, exchanged an expressionless glance. "Morning, Ben," Quirk said. "Afternoon, I mean." He turned away to hang up his raincoat and his hat, and Sinclair grinned at Wilkins and lifted an invisible glass to his mouth and mimed drinking off a deep draught. Sinclair, a puckish fellow with a sickle of a nose and glossy black curls tumbling on his forehead, was the comedian of the department. Quirk filled a beaker of water at one of the steel sinks ranged in a row along the wall behind the dissecting table and carried it cautiously in a not-quite-steady hand into his office. He was searching for the aspirin bottle in the cluttered drawer of his desk, wondering, as always, how so much stuff had accumulated in it, when he spotted Mal's fountain pen lying on the blotter. It was uncapped, with flecks of dried ink on the nib. It was not like Mal to leave his precious fountain pen behind, and with the cap off at that. Quirk stood frowning, groping his way through an alcohol haze back to the moment in the early hours when he had surprised Mal here. The presence of the pen proved it had not been a dream. Yet there was something wrong with the scene, as he recalled it, more wrong even than the fact of Mal sitting here at this desk where he had no right to be in the watches of the night. Quirk turned and walked into the body room and went to Christine Falls' trolley and pulled back the sheet. He hoped the two assistants did not see the start he gave when he found himself confronted with the corpse of a half-bald and moustached old woman, the eyelids not quite closed, and the thin, bloodless lips drawn back in a rictus that revealed the tips of a row of incongruously white, gleaming dentures. He returned to the office and took Christine Falls' file from the cabinet and sat down with it at his desk. His headache was very bad now, a steady, dull hammering low down at the back of his skull. He opened the file. He did not recognize the handwriting. It was certainly not his, nor that of Sinclair or Wilkins, and the signature was done in an illegible, childish scrawl. The girl was from down the country, Wexford or Waterford. He could not make out which. The writing was so bad. She had died of a pulmonary embolism. Very young, he thought vaguely, for an embolism. Wilkins entered the room behind him, his crepe soles squeaking. Wilkins was a big-eared, long-headed Protestant, 30 years old, but gawky as a schoolboy. He was unfailingly, excessively, infuriatingly polite. "This was left for you, Mr. Quirk," he said, and laid Quirk's cigarette case before him on the desk. He coughed softly. "One of the nurses had it." "Oh," Quirk said, "right." They both gazed blankly at the slim silver box as if expecting it to move. Quirk cleared his throat. "Or which nurse was it?" "Nurse Rutledge." "I see," Quirk said. The silence seemed a demand for explanation. "There was a party upstairs last night," he said. "I must have left it up there." He took a cigarette from the case and lit it. "This girl," he said in a brisk voice, lifting the file, "this woman, Christine Falls, where's she gone?" "What was the name, Mr. Quirk?" "Falls, Christine. She must have come in sometime last evening. Now she's gone. Where to?" "I don't know, Mr. Quirk." Quirk sighed into the open file. He wished Wilkins would not insist on addressing him by his name in that crawlingly obsequious way every time he was called on to speak. "The release form," he said. "Where's that?" Wilkins went out to the body room. Quirk searched in the desk drawer again and this time found the aspirin bottle. There was one tablet left. "Here you are, Mr. Quirk." Wilkins laid the flimsy pink sheet of paper on the desk. The unreadable signature on it, Quirk saw, was the same, more or less, as the one in the file. At that moment he realized suddenly what had been odd about Mal's pose here at the desk last night. Although Mal was right-handed, he had been writing with his left. One of the more wicked characters among a cast of extremely wicked characters in this book is a young man called Andy Stafford. He's an American. He's a truck driver. He's married to a woman called Claire. They have both adopted a baby. And they're living in a house. They've been living in the top half, and in the lower half there's a single woman of a certain age called Cora Bennett. And these are a few pages about Andy, whom I'm very fond of, I have to say. Andy liked the night runs best. It was not just that the rate of pay was better, but that there was less traffic on the highway. Something about that high dome of darkness all around him and the headlights of the big 12-wheeler cutting through it made him feel in control of more than just this truck with its load of roof shingles or auto parts or pig iron. What all he did out here was up to nobody but himself. There was only him and the road and some heartsick hillbilly on the cab radio twanging away about hound dogs and lonesomeness and love. Often standing in the forecourt of a deserted gas station or stepping out of the late night smoke and fry smells of a roadside hamburger joint, he would feel the breeze on his face and seem to smell clean, sage-scented air coming to him like a message just for him, all the way from out west, from New Mexico or Colorado, Wyoming maybe, or even the high Rockies, all those places he had never been to. And something would well up in him, something sweet and solitary seeming and full of promise for the day to come, the day that was already laying down a thin line of gold on the horizon before him. He's on his way home and he gets into a fight in a bar. No point in going into the details of it. He's beaten quite badly, but he sort of gives as good as he gets. He's a little guy, but he's tough. And this is the bit where he gets home. It's really just a couple of pages. Yeah, it was midnight when he coasted the rig down Fulton Street and drew to a squeaking stop outside the house. The upstairs was dark, and there was only a faint line of light under the blind in the window of Cora Bennett's bedroom. He suspected lonesome Cora slept with the light on. He got himself down from the cab, jangling all over with pain, but feeling still the excitement of the fight, a tingle like foxfire all along his nerves. The fall night air was chill, and he had only his windbreaker to wear, but he did not feel like going inside yet. He climbed the porch steps, dragging a leg. Someone had kicked him on the ankle. And he sat down on the swing, careful not to set it going and make the chains creak. He did not want Claire coming down in her night things and fussing over him. Not just yet, anyway. His head ached, his left knee as well as his ankle was aching. His mouth was all cut up at one side, and a molar there was loose. But he was surprised not to have been more badly hurt. He leaned his head back on the swing and eased out a long sigh, holding his aching chest in both hands. It was gusty, and clouds were racing across the sky, black and shiny as paint, and the walnut tree at the side of the house was rattling its dry leaves. There was a full moon. He heard the porch door opening behind him. He did not turn or move at all, just went on sitting there, looking at the sky and the clouds. And for a moment he saw the whole scene as if from outside it, the windy street, the moonlight coming and going on the yard, the porch all in shadow, and him there, hurting and quiet, and Cora Bennett standing behind him with an old coat pulled on over her nightshirt, saying nothing, only raising her hand slowly to touch him. It was like one of those scenes in a movie when the whole audience knows exactly what is going to happen, yet holds its breath in suspense. She came around in front of him and knelt down on both knees and put her face close up against his. He smelled the sleep on her breath and the stale remains of the day's face powder. Her hair was untied and hung in trailing strands like a slashed curtain. He flicked the last of his cigarette into the yard. It made a red, spiraling arc. "You're hurt," she said. "I can feel the heat from your face." She touched with her fingertips the bruises on his jaw and the swollen place at the side of his mouth, and he let her and said nothing. When she leaned closer still, her face framed by her hair was shadowed and featureless. Her lips, cool and dry, were nothing like Claire's, and when she kissed him there was none of Claire's eagerness and anxiety. It was like being kissed in a ceremony by some kind of official. It was as if something was being sealed. She said, drawing away, "You taste of blood." He put his hands on her shoulders. He had been wrong. He was not wearing a nightshirt, but was naked under the coat. This is getting very steamy, isn't it? It was strange. Cora was, he guessed, 10 years older than he was, and her stomach had marks on it that made him guess she must have had a child herself at some time in the past. If so, where was the kid, and where was the kid's father? He did not ask. The only photograph he saw in a fancy silver frame on the night table beside her bed was of a dog, a Yorkshire Terrier, he thought it was, wearing a bow around its neck and sitting up on its hind legs and grinning with its tongue out. "That's Rags," she said, reaching out a bare arm and picking up the frame. God, did I love that mutt. They were sitting on her bed, she at the top end, naked with a pillow on her lap, and he at the foot, leaning back against the wall, wearing only his shorts and drinking a beer. The bruises on his ankle and knee and all around his rib cage were coming up blue already. He could imagine what his face looked like. The only light was from a shaded lamp on the night table, and in it everything in the room seemed to droop downwards, as if the whole place was wilting in the rank heat of the steam radiator humming and hiccuping under the window. He had hardly spoken in the hour he had been here, and then only in a whisper, uneasily aware of his wife's sleeping presence somewhere close overhead. He could see his nervousness amused Cora Bennett. She watched him now with a faint, sceptical smile through the smoke of her cigarette. Her breasts were flat along their fronts, a droop like everything else in the place. They gleamed amber-coloured in the lamplight. She had pressed his throbbing face between them, and a drop of her sweat had run into his mouth and stung his burst lip. He had never been with a woman as old as she was. There was something excitingly shameful about it. It had been like sleeping with his best friend's mother, if he'd had a best friend. At the end, when the fierce storm they had whipped up between them was over, she had cradled him against her, nursing his bruised and burning body, as he had sometimes seen Claire hold the child. He could not remember his own mother ever holding him like that, so tenderly. Thank you.
Thank you for those readings. What we'll do at this point is we'll open it up to a Q&A, and if you have a question, hold your hand up and we'll get a mic to you. Who'd like to start us off? No questions? Well, then we'll see you upstairs for the books. Anybody? Yes, sir, in the gray. If you could please wait for the mic, sir.
Hi, thank you, both of you. Just listening to what Mr. Wilson said as part of an introduction and then listening to you read, it makes me wonder why we don't read all your books by listening to them rather than conspiring in silence to try and reinvent them. So could you talk about that? Is there a difference between reading them in silence and listening to you read them? Or others read your work aloud?
You have to beware Irishmen with the gift of the gab, you know. Don't you think?
Yeah, I think. But when I teach, if I teach creative writing, I tell my students that they have to read it aloud, in order to get the rhythm down and to notice all those words that repeat themselves when they shouldn't repeat themselves. And it seems to me that you create a voice, you hope to create a voice in the book that sort of resonates in the reader's head. I do like listening to readings. Do you like readings?
I always remember this wonderful formulation of Mary Heaney's, Seamus Heaney's wife, who said that Flann O'Brien had said there's no such thing as a large whiskey. She says there's no such thing as a short reading. I don't know. I think the problem is, I remember reading an essay by Donald Thomas many years ago, who said that the problem with writers reading their own work aloud is that they dwell lovingly on the lines that they like, and that it's not necessarily those lines that are the best ones. I think there is a problem. Mind you, I hate actors reading one's work. Actors destroy prose because they give all the wrong emphases. But I do think that there is a danger that we fall too much in love with our own. The sentences we think are lovely, which are not necessarily.
I remember growing up and listening to Dylan Thomas, and you know, my father would put Dylan Thomas on, you know, Child's Christmas in Wales, and thinking it was one of the most extraordinary things I ever heard, and I didn't find any misplaced emphasis in his poetry or anything like that. I quite loved it.
Oh yes, I mean we all. I was thinking when you were talking earlier about libraries in your introduction, remembering that I spent a great deal of my childhood in the Wexford County Library, Wexford, a little town in the southeast of Ireland, not the hub of the universe, as it thought it was. And I spent a lot of time in the library, which was an escape. But I stole a book from the library. I loved the place. When I came in here tonight, that smell of libraries is unmistakable. But I hid a volume of Dylan Thomas's poetry, a lovely hardback dent edition of his poems. I hid it behind the shelves for 6 weeks and I waited. Since nobody noticed that it was gone, I thought it wasn't needed. So I stole it, and I still feel guilty about that. And, but I have left some money in my will to Wexford Library to replace this. The trouble is, when I was talking to the solicitor, she drew up the will in such a way that it seemed that the amount of money I'd left was for innumerable books that I had stolen. So I had to emphasize that I'd stolen one book. And the amount of money I was leaving was entirely disproportionate. Sorry, that's a complete segue into nothing. But yes, I mean, it was lovely to listen to Dylan Thomas. He taught us a lot about the English language and about rhythm and about the music of language. I agree with you, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Another question about, yes, right here in the aisle.
Colin, when you were researching for your book for Zoli, did you base your research only on the research at the library in New York, or did you do any direct interviews with any Roma individuals? And also, do you see any parallels between the Roma community in Europe and the Irish travelling community in terms of how they're ostracised and stigmatised in Ireland, but also in terms of the their cultural heritage, in terms of their, you know, musical talents and their creativity?
Yeah, you know, I stumbled upon this story and I saw a picture of Papushka and I sort of fell in love with her and fell in love with the idea of this gypsy intellectual, you know, and because it seemed to me to be the different story than the story that normally been told. And I couldn't get her out of my mind. So I spent 2 years, best part of 2 years in the library. But there's not an awful lot of stuff about the Roma. You know, there's a lot of shoddy scholarship. More recently, in recent times, people like Ian Hancock down at the University of Texas have been changing all that, the Center for Romani Archives and things. But I couldn't have imagined, this was the most difficult novel I've ever written, because I couldn't have imagined what it was like. And I had to go across, so I spent a couple of months in the camps in Slovakia. I went from the border of Austria all the way across to the border with Poland and right over to the former Soviet Union, and stayed in the camps and slept in the camps, and found that, you know, I had guides because I couldn't speak Romani and I couldn't speak Slovak, but my guides would leave me, you know, at night because they didn't want to sleep in the camps, and I did. And the only language I had was the language of song, and I would sing these old Irish songs. Some of them were actually old Irish traveller songs as well. And while there's ethnically no link between the Roma community and the Irish travellers, there are massive similarities in the way that they've been treated, in the way that, you know, old blood laws and things like this, and attitudes to music and family and so on. But I'll tell you, like, you wouldn't believe the amount of discrimination I've met families that were burnt out, women who'd been sterilized in Slovakia just 5 years ago, you know, extraordinary things that were going on. But somewhat what captures it best is that just a few years ago, Miss Czech Slovak got up on television during the beauty pageant where they all have to say, oh, you know, I want to save the world and rescue everything. And she says, yes, I want to become a public prosecutor so I can clean out my town of all its brown-skinned inhabitants. And, you know, that sort of stuff is still going on, and I know it's going on in Ireland too. Do you have any links with the with the traveller community or know anything about
it? No, I suspect my mother used to always say I shouldn't investigate too far into my background, and I'd probably find that there was tinker blood there somewhere. I suspect we all have a certain amount of it, but I don't know.
My mother used to say to me, she said, you know, you better behave yourself or the gypsies will come take you away. And I was in a camp one night in this mud and wattle hut, and this woman was berating her 8-year-old, 9-year-old son. And I asked my guide, I said, what was she talking? She said, be careful, the white man will come take you away.
Goes around. Another question, please. Right in front. If you could just wait for the mic. If you could hold your hand up, too.
This isn't really a question. I just want to tell you that I enjoyed Soli. And I became part of her. You were so descriptive in everything about it. The smells, you can taste the food, you can feel the people. And that's what you did to me with Soli.
Well, thank you so much.
It was wonderful.
That's a very nice thing to say. And I think I have to say this right now. We get our voice from the voices of others. And you know, I never even got a chance to say to you, John, what an important thing it's been to, like, you know, read your books and, like, for the generation coming up and looking at, you know, the work that you've done for us. That's what we do. We recently had Ben Kiley leave us. And you know, but your work has been extraordinarily powerful.
Well, thank you.
Through the years.
I hope not to leave for a while yet.
No, you won't be. No. I'm not talking about leaving.
But thank you. I appreciate it.
Lady here in the black and the red. Now, just speaking to it again, they'll turn
Sorry.
It on.
There we go. This is a question from Mr. Banville. I'm a fan. I've read a number of your books. I haven't had a chance to read this one yet. I'm very curious about your decision to write a crime novel. Why? What were you thinking? What interested you about it?
Oh, I think for fun, really. I have always read crime novels. I like them. I don't like the notion of genre. You know, there's just good books and books that are not good. And I always admired, there are some wonderful writers. I don't know if you read Richard Stark, real name Donald Westlake. He wrote a series of books about a character called Parker in the early 60s, and he's still writing. I'm meeting him tomorrow, looking forward to it. Obviously not many fans of Richard Stark here, but anyway. So I wanted to do something like that. And then a few years ago, I began to read George Simenon, whom I'd never read before. Not the Maigret novels, which I don't like very much, but what he called his hard novels. And I was immensely impressed by the effects that he could achieve by very simple language, very straightforward narrative voice. And I thought, I'm going to try and see if I can do something like that. I have no hope of achieving Simenon's extraordinary economy of means. I wish I could do it. But I wanted to do something like that. And also, I think it was a way of breaking away from the series of books I've been writing since the early 80s, first-person narratives by men in trouble. I did a reading a few years ago at the Edinburgh Festival, and there was a woman sitting in the front row, and I could see her glaring at me, and I knew that when the question and answer session came, she was going to be the first one with her hand up. And sure enough, she said, when are you going to stop writing these awful books about these dreadful men killing women? And I said, well, you know, I'm like Bart Simpson at the beginning of the Simpsons episode. I keep writing on the board. I would keep doing this and I get it right. I would keep doing this. And I felt that in Shroud, the book before the sea, that I had got it as right as I was ever going to get it, and that I needed to do something else, and I wanted to break away. And The Sea was a transition novel. The Sea, the book came after Shroud. But looking back now, I see that Christine Falls was another part of that transition to something else. But, it, you know, I enjoy it. It amuses me. I've never been interested in character or plot or action or any of that stuff that novelists are supposed to be interested in. And suddenly here I am, you know, discovering this in my, I was going to say on the brink of old age, but sort of, I was stepping firmly into old age. So I feel like a child who's found a new toy. And it's amusing and it's an experiment. It may not work. I don't know, I may be making a dreadful mistake. But that's what writers do. We take risks.
Why don't we take one last question, gentleman in the blue.
Hi, I have a question for Mr. Banville about why you chose to write as Mr. Black for this novel, and does Mr. Black have any more novels in him?
Well, I decided to use a pseudonym. It would be an open pseudonym. I was never going to pretend that it wasn't me. But I did that simply to indicate to my loyal readers, my few hundred loyal readers, that this was a different venture, I was afraid that people would think it was an elaborate Nabokovian literary trick that was being played on them. I want people to realize this is, you know, it's what you see is what you get, and this is something new that I'm doing. So that was why I chose. And yes, I'm just finishing a second book in this series. I can't believe it. I mean, you know, I write thousands of words a day as Benjamin Black, and I write as John Banville. If I get 200 words done in a day, I would feel very lucky indeed. So I distrust deeply this awful facility that Benjamin Black has, but I will have to cut him loose at some stage and say, go live your own life.
Well, thanks to Benjamin Black and to Colin McCann. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.